Welcome to I Want to Put a Baby in You, a podcast exploring reproductive technology and life-changing stories. Here are your hosts, Jennifer White and Ellen Trackman.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Ellen Trackman, here with the incredible and amazing Jennifer White.
I get adjectives again?
I know.
2 weeks in a row?
I have to add them, but there weren't as many this time.
Okay.
I have to work on that.
Maybe I'm not as amazing this time.
Shake them up. No, you were amazing. Definitely amazing. Other adjectives. I guess not as beautiful. No, still beautiful.
Oh,
still beautiful.
Ooh, ouch. No.
I can't even see you. I don't know. Beautiful inside and out. I can hear the beauty.
Good. Okay, thank you.
Speaking of all the amazing things you are, including amazing and beautiful and brave, our topic for today, our chit-chat topic, is tell me one of the bravest things that you feel like you've ever done.
I feel like one of the bravest things I ever did, and I know this feels a little self-serving on this podcast, is like start our surrogacy agency.
I was gonna say going into business with my sister.
It's not that part. Like that.
Okay, not that part. Okay, right, good.
I mean, it's like all of the logistics and the like. Suddenly, when you start to have employees who depend on you for like their paycheck and things like that,
yeah,
it was really scary, you know, to think that, you know, I am now responsible for people's livelihood if something happens to this business. And especially, I will say, during COVID, and keeping my brain about me during COVID, during that, I feel like that was one of the like bravest times of my life, is like to put on that big brave face and go through it.
I mean, the employees definitely, but also the clients, the people you're supporting. It's such a sensitive time. Yeah. So, you know, so many emotions involved. It's a lot and a big responsibility.
I mean, I figured I could support them for free forever if I had, you know, like just, I would just like finish it out, but like.
Right. But you can't support your employees for free, for sure.
Correct. And so that's why I was like, okay, I could finish out cases if something happened. Like I would just do it for, you know, as long as I needed to. But like, yeah, it was. I think now like everything is in a place where like, you know, we're post COVID and everything is good and like that, but it was like, whew, starting a business and then COVID hitting like a couple years later was tough, and I feel like that was a brave thing, which actually segues really
speaking
nicely. We talk about people starting their own businesses. I mean, let's talk to Dr. Witzke.
Welcome, Justine Witzke, to the podcast. Where to start? I was starting to give like all your credentials, like PhD, MPH, doctor. No, don't use doctor. Should I use it? Because we had just talked about how it can be pretentious. But despite all that, Justine, please introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about yourself. And then I'm excited to talk about a lineage fertility, your new endeavor shortly after that.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for having me. My name is Justine Witzke. I have had the privilege, and I really use that word very specifically, but the privilege of working in reproductive medicine for about 16 years now. Much of that time, more than 15 years of it, was at Weill Cornell's IVF program in New York City. I was lucky to have a variety of roles of increasing responsibility there, including getting to formalize the fertility preservation program and being head of clinical operations for like 8 or 9 years. And while I was doing that, I did study, as you said, public health. I did a master's in public health at Hunter College and then a PhD in clinical and translational research at Mount Sinai School of Medicine here in New York City. And now with a Lineage Fertility, which is a sperm bank and fertility consultancy, my dissertation work makes me seem incredibly organized, because my dissertation was on commercial donor sperm preparation and whether the type of donor sperm that a patient purchased impacted pregnancy rates in IUI patients. So it was pretty interesting.
Wait, what did you find? Tell us about your dissertation.
It's been many years, so I'm not sure I have all the numbers still in my head, but basically what's available to patients from most commercial sperm banks is something called washed sperm or unwashed sperm. The unwashed is usually a little less expensive, maybe 10 or 15% less expensive. And most IVF programs and fertility programs are going to be washing the specimen, preparing it for use anyway. So we had this, I had this question of like, does it make a difference for the patient to spend more money, get the washed specimen and have it washed yet again at the fertility center?
Yeah.
Or can they use the unwashed specimen and save a little bit of money? And it turns out in the study that we looked at, which I think it was maybe over 1,000 cases. So quite a decent number of cases that I looked at. There was no difference in pregnancy rate. So it didn't say that the unwashed was necessarily better, but it did kind of give us confidence to keep telling patients what we had really always been telling them, which was
no,
it didn't matter. It didn't matter, but don't worry that the more expensive one, don't think necessarily the more expensive one is better. But for, the caveat to that is someone who's doing a home insemination would need the washed specimen in most cases because they're not necessarily having the non-sperm cells of the semen sample washed away, and you wouldn't necessarily want to place those into the uterus directly. So gets into a lot of detail at that point, but
yeah. And I'm sorry, I actually want to hear more. So for those,
do you?
Those who might be doing a home insemination, tell us, so they would want to buy washed.
Potentially. Yeah. So, okay. So there's, this could get, and it kind of depends what provider is guiding their care, if there is one, but I would say a general rule of thumb is if they're really going to be able to place the specimen into the uterus, past the cervix and get the specimen into the uterus, you would want some sort of washing, whether it was washed up front at the commercial sperm bank or if it's washed at a fertility center or a laboratory that can do that. Because in the semen sample, there's not just sperm. There are all kinds of other cells, potentially virus cells and those sorts of things. And these are all normal and expected. But you wouldn't necessarily want to place those into the uterus. Now, if it's a home insemination where they're placing the specimen into the vagina and the specimen's then going to travel through the cervix on its own, should be fine to use an unwashed specimen because the cervix is sort of protecting the uterus from those other cells.
Ooh,
and only sperm are passing through. So there can be, a lot of variation, as with all things in fertility, a lot of right answers to every question. So, if it's, could be a midwife or a fertility provider or a nurse or someone kind of helping guide the patient or prospective parent who's doing home insemination, that would be maybe a relevant question for them to have.
Yeah.
So I would say, so we dove straight into the big, like some of the big stuff, but what brought you into this area in the first place? We didn't go through the backstory here.
The backstory, yeah. So the very almost silly sounding answer is I got into fertility accidentally as a new grad from college. I was doing that master's in public health and I was looking for work and was very lucky to get this kind of patient services role in reproductive medicine. And the field is, to me, and I think to so many of us who've spent so many years working in this field, it's amazing how complex and how, I know I said this earlier, how much of a privilege it really is that people let you into this part of their lives, that they let you help them navigate these complex decisions that include medical decisions, but also social and ethical and logistics and fiscal decisions for their lives. They're just a tremendous amount of resources, time, money, energy, all of these things dedicated to building a family through reproductive technologies, and to be permitted to participate in that. I loved it from the beginning. And I love that there are a lot of right answers to every question and that the same treatment plan isn't the right thing for everybody who's walking in our doors. So I just grew with the field. I think it's incredible. And even if some of us have done the same job, quote unquote, for quite a long time, the work changes so much. That saying of, if you're not moving forward, you're moving backwards, is glaringly apparent all the time in this field, because what a family looks like changes over time. What treatment plans we can offer to a patient changes over time. All of these things. And sometimes they're changing over a year or two or 5 years, you know, pretty short periods of time in my thinking.
Definitely. And with everything changing so quickly, I hate to jump ahead already, but tell us kind of what your vision was of where you wanted to go and why make this leap.
Yeah. So, you know, some of it is kind of a personal decision of what was the next thing for my career? How could I feel fulfilled in the work I was doing and hopefully help to, you know, keep moving this field forward and working with patients. I love talking to patients and I love navigating these things. And through my prior work, I got to be exposed to really so many facets of the field, the regulatory compliance piece, patient satisfaction, working with physicians, laboratory staff, with reproductive attorneys, with institutional attorneys, with you know, all of the members of this community in this field. And what I kept noticing is that for many people who were ultimately needing an andrology lab, a sperm bank to help them, whether that was a young person with cancer who needed to freeze sperm, or a trans woman looking to preserve fertility for the future, someone using a known sperm donor, or an intended parent making embryos for a surrogate, that for many of these people, neither a urologist nor a reproductive endocrinologist is exactly the person meant to do that kind of work, right? They kind of fall a little bit between the cracks.
That's interesting.
And, you know, it's all related. And of course, we all need to work together. And I think that's actually why I have the consultancy arm of the business, even, is that I think if we all work together, the whole field benefits, the patients benefit, our businesses do well, all of these things really go hand in hand in my mind. But, you know, going back to the clinical side of it, it really felt like navigating some of these, you know, psychosocial questions and regulatory questions and, you know, executing this sperm freezing, semen analysis, sperm freezing, and donor testing and screening at a really high level was something that seemed to be missing for a lot of patients. And here we are. We're here to do this. We've been lucky to see patients in all of those groups already in our new facility, which is in Midtown Manhattan. We're very, very thrilled with the location and the space. But it's while those patient groups may on the surface level not seem like they have overlapping needs, the clinical requirements and some of the special considerations in their decision making are really quite similar.
It is a really interesting kind of place you are making in the world, because I don't know how you explain to people, like if they ask, are you a fertility doctor? No, right? Are you
right.
a sperm bank? No, you're not a sperm bank, right? Kind of, maybe
we are.
Maybe a little
we are.
More.
You know,
okay,
we
yes,
are,
but not a traditional one.
Not necessarily a traditional one, right? So people, when people think of a sperm bank, because this is what the media sort of portrays
yes,
to them, and
yes.
it's what maybe has existed over the last 40 or 50 years, they're thinking of, I guess, you know, millions of vials of sperm in a freezer somewhere.
Yeah,
and,
kind of. Is that not right?
And almost like a, I don't want to overly simplify this, but in some ways like an Amazon shopping experience, you can read through profiles, you can make a decision and you can choose a sperm donor. And that works for a lot of people. That has been the model for a very long time. It's incredible how long it's been the model and how creative and, you know, forward thinking people were when that started, right? Like that's just, it's amazing. However, we've learned so much. And like we were saying, you know, what a family looks like is different. What people want out of a sperm donor may be different now than what they previously had desired or even thought was available to them. So we are a sperm bank in the sense that we do semen analysis. So we test sperm and we freeze sperm and we store it on site. We also do a lot of care coordination. We also do donor testing and screening for people who need that. And that's all regulated by FDA and in New York, it's the New York State Department of Health. We're also building closer to a traditional sperm bank as part of our work, where we'll recruit sperm donors.
The question, whether you're,
we are intending to do that. Yes. So we're recruiting sperm donors, and regulations require a 6-month quarantine for sperm donors who are not known to the recipient. So if we recruit a sperm donor, we'll test and screen him. And that testing and screening involves, of course, health medical records review, health history, family health history, genetic testing, genetic counseling, psychological testing, infectious disease testing, sperm testing and freezing, a lot of workup that goes into this. That quarantine period.
And you said, of course, like, I feel like that's not actually the way it has been traditionally up until now for a lot of sperm banks, though. Especially when you look at some of these cases about like psychological, like the background and things like that, that were missed in some cases. So has that always been the standard of care, or are you talking about an improved and different?
So I believe that that has at minimum been a recommendation, but should have been the standard of care for quite some time. How it is executed, of course, depends on the team and the decision makers involved in that. For our team here at Alineage, we're working with experienced reproductive psychologists. I know there are some programs that have social workers do those meetings, you know, and certainly a lot of trained professionals can be capable of doing it, but I do think it's a really important part of it. Not necessarily because we think, oh, there's a high percentage of people applying who are going to have some psychopathology that is potentially genetic, and not necessarily even those things, but just that it can also be psychoeducational, and that the donor can be presented with all of these special considerations of what he or they may think about it later on in life, or when they have their own child, or if they have a different partner at a different time in life, and that these are all considerations that they should try to imagine now for the future before they make such a significant commitment.
It's interesting, in Colorado, where I am, this law was passed to protect donor-conceived persons, and in the next year, we'll implement all these regulations in terms of no truly anonymous donation, limitations on how one donor, how many families can use a specific donor, so there's not these like mega families. How does your bank, can I call a bank now? How does your area, how do you address these type of issues?
So we, you know, we're trying to apply a lot of these learnings that have occurred over the last several decades and take all of these things into consideration of what is suitable and, desired by, and of course, legal and appropriate in each geography, but what do patients want? What do donors want in these arrangements? And I think the answer is they want a lot of different things, right? We need a lot of solutions to the same question, in my view. So we are definitely planning for our donor bank, where we're recruiting donors, and we'll And I'll, if I can, just give a little detour on that. What we're intending to do, of course, is, like I mentioned, all of that testing and screening up front, the quarantine, and then there's an end of quarantine infectious disease testing that occurs as well. So it's about a 7-8 month process at minimum before a sperm donor you recruit today, their samples might be available to a potential recipient. And, you know, I mentioned earlier that some of the sperm banks that exist now, it's you go online and choose your donor and basically add to cart, ship it to your fertility center. And there may be some additional paperwork and all sorts of things and different levels of information that are available about the donors. We are taking a different approach to how to match recipients and donors, where our team, who will have met and screened that donor, will meet the recipient and find out what they're looking for and hopefully be able to say, you know, we think you should look at these two or three profiles of donors based on what you're telling us, and be able to provide a more human connection by way of our team, so that somebody who met your donor is meeting you. And we think that that is really going to meet the needs of many patients who maybe feel that the current model is a little bit too arm's length and not quite personalized enough for them.
That's really interesting. So will the donor meet the recipient, and will they be able to say yes or no to recipients?
This is a very interesting and very relevant question in this line of work. So, you know, we're intending at minimum that we would have the donors agree to what is often referred to as identity release, where the child conceived from that sperm donor could request information when they're 18 years old. And in New York, we don't have a requirement right now to have fully open donation where the identity is known at the time of the donation. So that would be acceptable in this location, and is something that, given the status of direct-to-consumer genetic testing and social media even, I think addresses the fact that it's almost impossible to say that you could keep people fully anonymous from each other forever.
For sure.
And I don't think we can imagine that that's really possible now. But I don't discredit people that 40 years ago, they did think they could do that. And that they, you know, what exists now from a technological standpoint couldn't have been contemplated then. So it's just a whole different world that we're in. There is, but this concept of open donation, or I've kind of been thinking of it as facilitated known donation, where somehow the prospective known donor and the prospective recipient are introduced to each other, is a very interesting and relevant and modern take on sperm donation. I think there are some potential wonderful benefits to it, in the sense that maybe a donation that would have previously happened in a, you know, totally off the books, for lack of a better term, sort of way, could be funneled through the fertility process. And there could be genetic testing and psychological testing and all of these additional things, and infectious disease testing that we believe to be safety mechanisms. Those could be in some of these cases. It also could allow for donors, and this gets a little in the weeds, so my apologies, but could allow for donors who wouldn't otherwise qualify as sperm donors to serve as sperm donors if they are known to each other. And that goes, so
tell us.
So the FDA has us as tissue banking professionals make a, what they call a donor eligibility determination, after reviewing infectious disease, specific infectious disease testing, a risk questionnaire, health history form, physical exam. All of these things exist for the overarching theory of reducing the risk of transmission among people who are not sexually active and are not intended co-parents what have you. In reviewing all of that, we are tasked with determining this donor to be, quote, eligible or ineligible. And in order to be a non-identified or kind of formerly known as anonymous donor, you have to be eligible. So all of those risk factors have to be negligible or non-existent. And the testing, of course, would be normal in that setting. And we would determine that this is an eligible donor and they could be matched with someone who they don't know at that time.
So what's a risk factor that might make a potential donor ineligible under that scheme? But otherwise,
that's a perfect question. So there are lots and lots of things. Some of them more or less truly clinically concerning. Like, for example, if someone has lived in the United Kingdom for more than 3 months, they are ineligible due to an increased risk of mad cow disease.
Yes. Not that my husband is going to be a sperm donor, but that would make him ineligible.
Exactly.
Yep.
And I often will joke with patients, like, if you're walking in my office with mad cow disease, we know, and we're not really worried about you becoming a sperm donor, right? Like, that's not, that's not something that we really think of as clinically dangerous, but it's part of the regulations, and it is important that we follow those regulations. So that's an example.
My husband also can't donate blood for that reason.
Exactly, right? And is that, maybe we could go into all kinds of tangents here.
I feel like they're in the 90s. I know, it's crazy.
Yeah. I totally agree with you. But also commonly, men who have sex with men are ineligible automatically, or if they have had sex with another man in the last 5 years. So, there's a whole potentially a prospective pool of sperm donors who are gay men or bisexual men who do not meet the criteria to be quote unquote eligible and therefore matchable with a non-identified recipient. And we're doing infectious disease testing. We have active information about, in many cases, there's not an added infectious disease risk. And if you had this facilitated known donation as an option, maybe some of those people would be interested in being sperm donors. That's yet another individual example.
It's brilliant. I think it makes so much sense that there is this pool that could be great donors and now there's a means for it.
Right. But are there some special considerations with it? Absolutely. Because now you're involving another person or person and their partner or family in your family building arrangement. And that's an important decision to make. And it's important to think about what that relationship, the expectations of that relationship are moving forward for all of the members of the arrangement, whether it's the recipient, maybe recipient partner, donor, maybe the donor has a partner, a lot of people potentially involved in this. So there's a lot to think about with it. And I think that's part of the beauty of the work we get to do at A Lineage Fertility is have those conversations and facilitate those conversations so that everybody who's involved feels comfortable and confident moving forward. Because we see plenty of cases over the years in a lot of different settings where it seems great initially and everybody seems on board. And then after contemplating it, some member of the arrangement decides they no longer feel comfortable with moving forward. And that's fine. And in my opinion, what I have always done and what I will continue to do is I will tell every member of these arrangements, if at any point you decide you don't want to go forward, you tell us and we will say that we can't go forward. We will try to preserve your relationship with this person who you know, and you don't necessarily have to tell them you decided. We can tell them that we can't move forward, and we'll take that responsibility.
But there has to be a point, right? That you, like, they received the sperm, they formed embryos, that they can't, that the donor's not vetoing at that point, right?
Oh, yeah. But in the screening process, I think it's perfectly reasonable that the donor could, maybe after meeting with the psychologist, they feel like, actually, those were some things I hadn't considered. That's kind of the point of some of the screening, right? Is that we get to make sure everybody feels really informed and really comfortable and really confident with their decision. But I totally agree that once the donation has been made and procedures have taken place, you've agreed by that point. And there are consent forms along the way, and I'm sure you could provide us much more information on the legal agreements that are often in place in these known donor arrangements.
I feel like it's rude to ask, but curiosity is forcing me to. What are donors paid?
Well, it really is an
We always
interesting
ask our guests
question.
beforehand if there's anything that we shouldn't ask, and I love the pause here. I'm like, uh-oh, maybe we crossed
I
the line.
think if you look it up, it's something like $75 to $200 per specimen that the donors are paid.
As in the market generally?
Yeah, like
Okay.
if you were to Google, like, what does a
Yeah.
sperm donor make? And every clinic, of course, for sperm bank, excuse me, of course, is going to have these donors come in for a different number of visits. So their total amount of money that they might get is variable depending on the number of visits that they make. And when we're considering these things and what we put into consideration for our own program is we're going to ask donors probably to come in for fewer visits than some other sperm banks because we do want to limit the number of families that could be built from the same sperm donor.
Interesting.
And
Good.
so then there's some, accounting and actuarial work that needs to be done on what's the appropriate compensation then in order to, of course, appropriately recruit sperm donors, account for their time and effort and their commitment to our program. And that's really what the compensation is for. But also acknowledge that if they were to go to a different sperm bank, they might be able to make more money by just going for more visits.
And
And
it's
it's a
not
bit of a
like
balance.
we do see sometimes in like the egg donation world where a potential egg donor might receive higher compensation, not based on time and effort, which is often what it's, pretending to be, but it's more about a certain score or a certain university she went to or other background elements. Is there any of those elements that factor into compensation in the sperm donation side?
So I've heard recently of some like third-party agencies getting into sperm donation. We've had egg donation agencies for many, many years in this field, and the compensation has ranged for those donors who have worked with certain agencies, but that hasn't been a part of the sperm donation field or subfield, I suppose, historically. But I have heard of it recently, and I wonder what that will look like. I wonder if there is this such a thing as this kind of facilitated known donation, if there then is a financial or economic consideration in some of those arrangements.
But
If
it's
someone agrees.
not your model yet, now that you have the international travelers with the mad cow disease that might be highly sought after. I don't know.
We can imagine a scenario where someone says, I'm willing to be a known sperm donor, but this is the fee I want. And I don't know that that's necessarily the role of a Lineage Fertility. We are the andrology laboratory, we're the tissue bank. But is there some other entity within our field who will be facilitating that sort of matching and negotiation?
We could
it sounds
pull
like
it
an
out,
invite.
Probably,
It sounds like
right?
an invite just for someone to start this business.
Maybe. Maybe I've just given a free idea to somebody.
So we'll switch off of that for a second. So tell us what else a Lineage is doing differently now that you're kind of starting your own, you have free reign to kind of change things as you see fit. What else have you seen needed changing, or you see ways to kind of be progressive and offer different options or means? Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, for me, so much of, and I know that this sounds kind of similar to what is out there in the world, but maybe I'll be able to come up with some examples to elucidate what I'm getting at. But I think there is, as time has gone on and fertility treatments have become more commonplace and the general public is more aware of the possibilities within fertility treatments, I think that our field has not intentionally and not in with any mal intent, same word there, that's good, but has not necessarily, has maybe assumed too much knowledge of the patients, where a patient walks in and says, yes, I know what IVF is, but maybe they know what IVF is because their friend did it, or they heard about it on the news or on TV or somewhere else.
Well,
and
the word IVF so interchangeably. Also.
Right. With so many things. And yeah. We know that IVF can mean a whole host of different procedures and variations. And there's a whole language to this of embryology, of acronyms. I often talk about acronyms. It's really like you could spend hours writing lists of acronyms. And sometimes even in this field, there are the same acronym is used to mean different things in different contexts, which is really challenging. Challenging enough for professionals, let alone for people who aren't, you know, haven't spent their whole lives thinking about fertility. So
I will actually, the one that makes me laugh the hardest is that I'm really glad that they changed it to STIs for sexually transmitted infections, because short-term disability is something we use in surrogacy all the time. And
oh,
so
wow.
I would see references to STDs all the time. And my brain would be like, STDs. Mm. Oh, wait.
I mean, that's actually one. That's one I never even would have thought of. So I have to add that to my list now. But one I think of all the time is GC. So GC could mean gestational carrier, could be genetic counselor, could be gonorrhea, chlamydia, could be a lot of different things depending on the context. And, you know, for us to navigate that as people who've been kind of speaking this language, that's one thing. For someone who's kind of making their first entry into the fertility world as a patient, think how additionally intimidating that is, let alone the time and money and energy, and you have to inject yourself maybe, or you have to give sperm at a sperm bank, or you have to do things that are maybe outside of your comfort zone. And so I really think it's so important to spend time talking to the patients, ask them what they want, ask them what their family looks like in the future to them. And, you know, I could use like maybe a simple example, but, you know, if let's say there's a young man with cancer who wants to freeze sperm before treatment, historically, you know, his oncology team would help facilitate that, provide a sperm sample, they would do a semen analysis, and they would freeze. And there would never be a discussion, in most cases, with that person of, who do you expect will use this sperm? Do you expect you'll have a female partner who will use it? Do you expect that you might have a male partner who, and you'll need a gestational surrogate? If that's the case, you should have donor testing and screening prior to freezing that sperm. And it's wonderful that the oncology teams and, you know, these other care teams who are working with patients doing fertility preservation are sending their patients for fertility preservation. That's a huge improvement over what we saw 10 or 15 years ago. But there's yet an added layer that sometimes I don't think is addressed. And as a simple example, but it's something that, you know, that's a critical part of what we're doing here at A Lineage Fertility. And I think maybe some people are intimidated to ask those questions or feel like they're maybe inquiring too much into the patient's history and life, but that's what we're here to do. We're here to be part of the care team and really think about them as a whole person, and that we're helping them be able to use the specimen the way they want to, when they want to. That makes sense.
That's so interesting. So important. Other thing, I mean, now I'm just like fascinated. Any other elements you feel like have been antiquated or aren't being done the right way, or that you found a new path that you'd want to share?
Yeah. So I guess like that sort of line of thinking is how we've gone about everything. So how can we be compliant with the regulations, with the requirements, with the laws? How can we meet the needs of the clinic that this person is going to use the specimen at, because we're working with all sorts of IVF clinics or centers, and how can we meet the needs of the patient and their partner, their family, and be able to do that where they feel taken care of, they feel comfortable, confident, and really, really build trust with us. I think there's a tremendous amount of trust required of patients, and that is something that none of us should take for granted, in my opinion. And I think it's incredibly important that we recognize that and address it with the patients. So there's really this like humanity piece of it that is critically important to us. The patient experience, and I don't know if you've talked about this on prior episodes, if not, it'd be, I think, a great thing to spend more time on with one of the experts. But there are some published papers and really quite compelling data that the number one reason why patients drop out of fertility treatment before their family is complete is because of the patient experience. It isn't because of the money or the injections or the things that we might assume.
I think I would assume money.
You're the first in 2 days that has talked about that, actually.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad other people are thinking about it. That makes me extremely happy.
Yesterday was the first time I had heard it too. So I was like, okay, good. It's coming to consciousness here.
Yeah. I mean, that honestly makes me so happy. But to think about that and to think about the fact that all we need to do to help these patients build their full family is be respectful and thoughtful and caring toward them. That should be a given. That should be how we do every single thing in the work we're doing, in my opinion. So that's how we're going about this. We also, you know, we're incredibly lucky to have this brand new, beautiful facility and an expert team. So we feel like we've been able to bring together the, you know, technical expertise and the setting and this approach and care. And, you know, we say in our kind of tagline, excuse me, boutique human-centered sperm bank and fertility consultancy. And that human-centered piece really is incredibly important to the work we're doing.
Nice. And for listeners, remind us where you are located.
We are located in Midtown Manhattan, 49th Street and Madison Avenue, readily accessible to public transit and all sorts of things. And there are a tremendous number of fertility programs in the New York City area. So we feel really lucky to be among some of the world experts and also among, you know, patient population who are very thoughtful about how they're building their families and very creative in how they're building their families in many ways. And I think it's just a tremendously wonderful place to do this type of work. So
Yeah. Well, this has been absolutely fascinating, and I am incredibly appreciative of you coming on and sharing, even when I make it awkward, that you've been very kind.
I appreciate it so much. I love talking about this stuff. I do hope that that comes across. And, you know, we would love to, you know, work with anybody in the fertility field with patients. And, you know, I think we should all be working together.
Thank you, Dr. Witzke, for joining us and taking the time. We're, you know, so amazed to see all the new innovations, the entrepreneurs out there, all the things they're doing. And plus, I feel like we learned a lot during this episode. Definitely things Absolutely. I didn't know.
Absolutely. You know, for people, if you want us to explore other bases of knowledge, you know, reach out to other professionals, learn new things for you or with you, give us a call at 303-997-1903. Leave us a message is what you're looking for, and we are happy to reach out. Also, you can self-nominate yourself. If you want to come on the podcast, reach out and tell us. We are happy to have anyone who wants to share their story. That's right. Be brave. Share your story. Tell the world. Or you can go to our website and send an email if telephone is not your thing. But please, we love when people reach out to us. Thank you, as always, to our team, to Melissa, to Tyler, and to Amanda. And thank you to all of you who come and listen.